Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, weird man, you're so weird. And then they'd go, should we go and have a drink? I go, no, I don't drink. I've worked on an oil rig and I'm a dancer. Come on.
This week on Walking the Dog, Ray and I went out for a stroll with comedian and actor Marcus Brigstocke, who's had a hugely successful career as a stand-up and is also well known for his TV appearances on shows like Have I Got News for You, Live at the Apollo and Would I Lie to You? Marcus doesn't have a dog, but he did tell me about his chameleon, who had me at the name Roy, frankly. I had the loveliest walk with Marcus, partly because he was so open and honest, but also because he's just fascinating, hilarious company. We also chatted about his wife, the super talented comedian Rachel Paris, and their new joint podcast venture called How Was It For You, which is a very funny weekly peek into their lives and dynamic together. And it launches next month, so do listen out for it. I really hope you enjoy my chat with Marcus, except for the bit where Ray interrupts someone's yoga class. Mortifying. I'll stop talking now and hand over to the man himself. Here's Marcus and Ray.
Raymond! Come on.
Come on, Raymond. How old is he?
Straight in with the age. I love
it. Well, can't tell with this flavour of dog, can you? He could be a puppy or a really elderly gent.
Do you know, his haircut is very forgiving.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
That's what I ask for when I go. I say, can you do something where people have to guess how old I am?
He is 7 years old.
Oh, okay. All right. So sort of approaching middle age.
Yeah, all right, Marcus.
Well, isn't that right? Listen, my chameleon Roy, is very nearly 9. That, I'm afraid, is getting around the sort of record-breaking age for chameleons.
Is it?
Which means he's either going to be a record breaker or I think he won't be with us very long.
Just a heads up, Ray does this sometimes. Apparently it's called stubborn Shih Tzu syndrome.
Stubborn Shih Tzu syndrome. Okay. And is that confined just to Shih Tzus or is that a thing that some people have? Because
I know a lot of people who've got stubborn Shih Tzu syndrome.
I've met a few producers that I would describe as having stubborn Shih Tzu syndrome. Yeah.
He just stops, Marcus.
Well,
like
yeah, that's it. Yeah, same with these producers. You think you're making progress and then they just stop. It's exactly the same.
Refuse to communicate. So I'm going to introduce you. I'm so thrilled to have you on this podcast.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
Because I've been a big fan of yours for many years. I am with the wonderful Marcus Brigstocke and we are with Raymond. And we're in North London. We're in Islington, which isn't actually your manor, I don't think.
It's not my ends. No, I'm a Balham man. Gateway to the south.
But you found yourself up in these parts today.
Yep.
Which suits me, because I'm a North London girl.
Oh, do you live near here?
Couldn't have been happier. In fact, nice. I grew up not far. We lived here briefly when it wasn't fashionable or expensive. My dad once said, we mastered the art as a family of living in the right suburb in the wrong decade.
Yeah.
So do you know what I mean?
There were loads of people who managed that. I mean, there are some people probably overlooking the park whose whole house cost them around £40. Who now spend their days complaining that young people, if only they drunk fewer lattes, could also buy a house.
So we're in Highbury Fields, which is really beautiful.
Where I've never been for a walk before.
Ah, this is your first time.
So this is, breaking new ground. I feel like a pioneer.
Right, I'm going to take Raymond off the lead, Marcus. You don't have a dog.
I don't. I grew up with dogs.
Did you? Talk me through the Brigstocke dog. And this was in Surrey, was it?
Yeah. My parents lived near a place called Hazelmere, and they had a Springer Spaniel called Bertie, who was a good egg, actually. He was really, really good. Very smart dog and good fun. And he was sort of, not unduly, but pleasingly terrified of my mother. And he'd wait until she went out. And then you could just see him studying the situation. Once she'd gone out, he'd start gently breaking rules, going on the sofa, going upstairs, just... And if he heard the door go, it'd be, yeah, lightning downstairs. But yeah, he was a lovely dog. And then they inherited a wire-haired dachshund called Schubert, who was also excellent, a lot of personality.
You see, the name Schubert, I love that, because that's telling me a bit about your family. I'm thinking quite cultured.
Yeah.
And
I mean, posh.
Yeah.
Let's jump to it. Posh. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Are you comfortable with just saying...
Yeah, definitely.
We were posh.
I think, actually, in my... Across my comedy, I've talked about poshness as much as I've talked about anything else apart from maybe politics. I mean, I did a long-running series called Giles Wembley Hogg Goes Off about posh gap year student who went travelling and sort of, you know, went... It's actually really amazing because, you know, I've seen poverty and I've got a lot of it on camera. You know, he was that guy. And actually, like, really well-meaning, decent, but awful. And would almost certainly have a cabinet position now.
They're always so well-meaning, and you know what? They've got the friendship bracelets.
Well, exactly, exactly. Often round their ankles.
Oh, Marcus.
Look, Raymond. I think Raymond may have pulled.
What's that? Is that a spaniel, Marcus?
Yeah, that is a spaniel. I couldn't say which one.
It looks very royal, so I'm looking to you. I think it is.
I think that is the spaniel that you often see rendered in porcelain. Isn't it? Right? I'm not wrong, am I? People have a pair of those on a mantelpiece. I can't tell you what it is, but anyone hopefully now has a visual reference for what we're looking at. It's a porcelain dog.
I can't work out whether it's got white markings on its nose or one of those sort of nose strips footballers used to have in the 90s.
Well, one thing's for sure, and that is Raymond is absolutely not bothered about that dog.
No.
Is he interested in other dogs?
Do you know, I've raised him to be unhealthily codependent with me.
Nice.
So that, you know, he's frightened of relationships outside of the home.
My parents are posh, our family is posh, and we knew posh people. But both my sister and I, my sister's a couple of years older than me, she moved to Canada when she was 19. And she was just going over there to sort of do something, and then she never came back. And I've always thought that quite a lot of that is because Canada really doesn't have a class system like ours. You know, blue collar and white collar people with very, very different means mix much more socially than the UK does, with the, I think, awful legacy of class. And then I had a very sort of weird childhood. I was expelled from lots of schools and ended up in rehab and various strange places. So I am posh, but I didn't grow up in those circles. So all the people that I'd have known in the first sort of, I don't know, 7 years of my life, there's one or two of them that I bump into maybe once every couple of years, but that's not my world, you know.
Let's get off this muddy track.
We ought really to have some sort of Sherpa for this.
So that's interesting, Marcus. Your dad was a stockbroker, is that right?
Well, he was, yeah. Back when he sort of first became successful, we have genuinely reached a quagmire now.
I'm so sorry, Marcus.
No, it's fine, it's fine. Do you know what? I go for a walk 2 mornings a week with my best friend. And we're a strong and important example of positive male friendship.
I love that.
It's really great. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we do. We meet up at least one, often two, sometimes 3 mornings a week, and we just walk around the park. And he always wears shoes that can't really go near any mud.
I like the sound
of him. And I usually wear shoes that can, but today I've come in sort of whitish shoes. My dad was a stockbroker, my mum was a teacher and then a head teacher.
And the rebellion thing, well, it sounds like it was a lot more than rebellion. There were obviously...
Yeah, there were definitely some issues. I have... I've been in 12-step recovery for addictions of various stripes for 30 something years now. So, and my relationship with kind of addictive, using substances and processes to medicate against feelings started when I was very young, really when I was about 7. And it was food for me first. Actually, if you scratch the surface with most addicts, drugs, alcohol, sex, whatever, you will find usually that they've had a really unusual relationship with...
I'm so sorry.
Oh, hello. Raymond has... Raymond's having a moment and has joined in someone's yoga class.
I do apologise. I'm so sorry, guys.
No,
I do apologise.
We're dog friendly here.
Oh, good. There's dog friendly and there's a dog running on your yoga mat.
She eats the yoga mat.
This is all part of the exercise.
Oh, well, thank you for being so lovely about it. Nice to meet you.
Raymond has just joined in a yoga class. That was so amazing. I say joined in. Raymond's joined in a yoga class in the same way I would, in that he attended. but that's it. He didn't help otherwise.
Oh, Marcus, go back to what you're saying.
I was saying, if you scratch the surface with a lot of people who have substance or process abuse problems, you will find that the first manifestations of how they medicated was with food. Because, because food is very early associated with love and approval. You know, we're breastfed and then weaned and then... You know, it's all, if you eat this, oh, well done, aren't you good? And if you have this, then there's a reward attached. Yeah. And if you have an addictive personality and lose the ability to distinguish between that being a perfectly normal thing for people and actually a thing that you can use as a comfort all the time, then you sort of end up doing what I did, which is going mad with it. And the thing that should be comforting becoming really destructive. So anyway... that the addiction stuff all just spiraled until it was really dangerously out of control and
you graduated essentially from food into
drugs and alcohol.
As a teenager.
Yeah.
That must have been really tough, Marcus.
Well, yes, it was. But I'm lucky in that my parents, I've had it, you know, had my problems with them over the years. I think most people do. I mean, with their own, not with mine. but you know, they just sort of kept trying to help, which often meant that I was furious with them and, you know, would swear they'd got everything wrong. But they just kept trying to help. And then when I did eventually sort of come out the other side of, for not just being an addict, but also addicts in early recovery are, bless their hearts, a terrible pain in the ass.
In what way?
Well, because it's, you have to replace one completely overwhelming thing with something else that completely overwhelms that. So, you know, if you think about the lengths that a drug addict will go to secure their next fix, the lengths an alcoholic will go to secure their next drink and conceal drinking and conceal drunkenness and same food addicts and all the rest of it. You know, it's absolutely overwhelming. It's all day from the moment you wake up to the moment you pass out. And so when you replace it, you need something that will take up as much time, which means you're sort of absolutely insufferable. for a long time and smug and judgmental and, you know, it's like when a friend gets into wellness now, I suppose. So all of that, you know, it took me a few years. Also, I was so young. Yeah. You know, I was only 17 when I stopped drinking and stopped taking drugs. And so everyone I knew was a recovering addict. Most of them had lived quite a full life that had involved a lot of carnage. And mine had, but in a sense, a smaller scale, just because I was younger. The damage was all to myself and, you know, some people that were hurt, but no one had been damaged otherwise. I hadn't broken a marriage down, for example.
But I think it's interesting, the fact that you were so young. I can imagine, and you know much more about this than me, that, you know, it's hard for it to take, I suppose, those that process of rehab, which is work, when you're young and unformed, which you were, that I imagine that's fairly rare at that young age to have that many successful stints in rehab, you know. I think there must have been, I find that interesting that you wanted to get better, essentially.
I did, yeah, I did. I actually remember that very, very clearly. It was a long time ago. But I remember being absolutely astonished at having found people who were talking openly about things that had been really close secrets for me for my entire life up to that point. And it was such a relief to have people be able to describe what it is to be compulsive around food and the lengths that you would go to, you know, which were awful, stealing from people that you love, eating from bins, you know, really just mad, eating when you're physically in a lot of pain from having overeaten, but just carrying on anyway. It's sort of the nearest I can get for people who haven't had that is Christmas afternoon, you know, when like a lot of people have it that day, like where they're absolutely stuffed, but somehow someone says, should we just make a turkey sandwich? And we may as well finish the quality street now. And you think, well, I'm in pain, but I'll crack on. Yeah. It's sort of that all day, every day. So, yeah, it was a huge relief. And so the opportunity for me to get better was one that I really relished. But I also, being so young, I had no other pulls on my life. Yeah. You know, I didn't have anyone I needed to get back to. So I worked at it really hard. And in those days, insurance would pay for you to be in rehab until, not indefinitely, until you were better, but they'd pay for you until you were better, more or less. Now, people going in, you know, they have just a few weeks, which is really only enough to, you know, for you to sort of begin to even detox, let alone look at any of the stuff that underpins it. What that did was sort of put a big, I mean, it changed how I think about everything. But it also put a big wedge between the life I might have led as a sort of, you know, posh public school boy and all that kind of stuff.
Hi.
Oh, thank you. Say hello. We're doing one now, actually, so you can sit. Nice to meet you.
That's so nice.
Do you know what? This is so lovely. And what I love is that they don't give a shit about me, because they just think, oh, who's that middle-aged woman? And they go, Raymond.
Oh, it's Raymond. It's all about you, Raymond.
Very healthy, though.
If they'd seen you joining that yoga class, they might change their view.
Do you know, I found that really impressive and moving, you talking like that, because even now I'm conscious that, you know, you can talk about it in a more detached way. But it must be, especially with the food addiction, that I presume that never goes away. And in some ways, it's the hardest.
It's so shit. It's so shit. It's annoying. You know, I've been sober from drugs and alcohol for, where are we now? 33 years. It's really amazing. And thank goodness for me and for everyone in my life that that's not, you know, it's just not been an issue. Nothing got broken. But the food thing, you have to decide three times a day when you've had enough, and I still, after all this time, find that really, really difficult. And the sort of the inbuilt comfort seeking that you know that food gives me is still something that I have to try and grapple with, you know, with really varying degrees of success.
Yeah.
Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Hello, look, Raymond has made another friend.
Is that a chihuahua, yeah? Long haired. What's the chihuahua called?
Harry.
Harry, this is Raymond.
Oh, Raymond. I love that, Raymond.
Oh, I like them. They're like two great train robbers' names, aren't they?
This is a really, really good meeting as well, because they're a similar size.
Yeah.
Is it Pekingese?
No, he's an Imperial Shih Tzu.
Oh, wow.
They were emperor's dogs.
Yeah.
And so... originally, and it was punishable by death if you had one outside of the palace, the royal palace. Wow. But, you know, we've survived.
Yeah, so yeah. I think we're fine. I'll just check.
Come on, Raymond.
Wow.
Hi, we're going to get a tea. Lovely to meet you, Harry. And you too, sorry.
I'm glad you were able to do with them what everyone does with Raymond and go, nice to meet your dog. May. Quite right. Quite right.
So, yeah, I can see that would be really hard because the food thing, it's daily, isn't it? That you can't, presumably, you know, with drugs and alcohol addiction, you say, well, I'll cut off the enablers, you know.
And you just stop too, you know, you just stop drinking, you stop taking drugs. But I also, it's taken a really, really long time, and I've changed my relationship with food and eating so that I can say hand on heart that the pain that my battle with it causes me and the difficulty I have with my weight is less important to me now than how I enjoy food socially. So I basically don't eat in between meals. I eat 3 meals a day and I don't snack, but I don't ever have cakes or puddings or biscuits or desserts, ice cream, any of that kind of thing. And that really helps, that simplifies things. So,
well,
what would you like?
We've got to the cafe now.
Sorry, Raymond, what would you like, first of all?
Look at him.
A Dairy Milk? I mean, Imperial, I'm afraid to say, Raymond, is such a good title for the face that you're now pulling. Imperious, to be fair.
He's a bit of a Karen.
Is he?
Well, he's got that. I would like to see them.
Yeah,
can I see
me.
Someone above your pay grade,
tap, tap,
please?
Tap. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to have... Hello. Can I have a latte, please?
I'll have a black Americano, please. Thank you.
We're going to take... We're going to have it to go, actually. Raymond.
Have you always had dogs?
No, he was I got him. I'd never had a dog. And he was part of a sort of reboot my life thing. Mm-hmm. My sister died and then my parents died and it happened all in this really small space of time. So I got him because I wanted joy in my life. And I thought actually bringing a little beating heart into your home.
Absolutely.
It just felt like the right thing to do.
It's interesting you say about the beating heart thing. That thing... you were holding Raymond as you said that. You presumably could feel his heart as you said that, right?
Yeah.
I held a baby goat last week. I went to a wonderful place called Norton and Yarrow, who make an award-winning cheese. It's come in the top 10 at the World Cheese Awards for the last 2 years, and I went to make cheese with them. It's brilliant. But I held this baby goat, and you could just feel its heart in your hand, and there's something absolutely kind of elemental about that feeling of you can literally feel the life of another creature. We feel that with each other, with people, because we can communicate or cuddle or whatever, but it's different with an animal, I think.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So we've got our... Thank you. We've got our... I've got my latte. Marcus has got his Americano.
He's so good at making friends, isn't he?
Marcus, is that he works the room.
Yeah, he's working
the room. He's a real operator, isn't he?
Yeah, definitely.
So, after everything you've told me, which is an extraordinary story, and extraordinary in that, you know, you overcame it and you got through it, and you went to university...
Yeah, so I had a weird period where when I came out of early recovery and rehab and all of that business, and I suddenly kind of went, oh, I've got no qualifications at all. you know, I had, I think, two GCSEs. And I thought, oh God, what am I going to do now? I had a feeling that I might not be thick, but I wasn't sure. There was no evidence to support it one way or another. So I just, I went off to college. I had some great jobs. I was a dancer for a while. I worked on an oil rig at the same time. Not as a dancer, but I would dance in London and then go and work in the North Sea and then come back. It's insane, but it is all true.
I'm not sure what to do, because this podcast isn't going to be long. I want to do an entire podcast.
Well, look,
podcast.
I can do a really truncated thing. I was 18, and I was 5'10", much shorter than I am now, and I weighed 24 stone. Right, it was huge. I was huge, morbidly obese. And in just over 7 months, I lost 13 stone. Right, so I more than halved my body weight in under a year. I was very rigid at that time in a way that I wouldn't want to be now. It was sort of just the right thing then, but unsustainable now.
Yeah.
And I reached probably the right weight for my height and age at that time, and then didn't, you know, I wasn't sort of under-eating or anything. But obviously my body was brand new. I was 19 and I had it was like being freed from prison. So I went out dancing a lot, like really a lot, and I just couldn't believe how it felt to be able to move and to, yeah, it was just this, it was so joyful. And so I kind of went dancing as much as I possibly could until I got talent spotted one night at Ministry of Sound, and they said, oh, do you want to come and dance with our crew of dancers? So I did that, and it was great. It was really fun. And I think, so there was like the brand new body thing, but there was also actually not being able to take drugs in a place, because Ministry had no bar, right? It was liquor free for the first 2 years. So everybody else, I'm going to say this with confidence, everybody else was on drugs. Everybody. I always found with, and I actually still feel the same with drinking and even drugs, although I guess I'm less comfortable around drugs now. But if I arrive as people are getting drunk, then I'm very happy. I'm absolutely fine. If I arrive and they're already drunk, it's absolutely unbearable to me and I have to leave. I just like, I can't walk into a drunken room. I'm like, I don't know how to join in. But I think with that, with the dance music, I would arrive in the same state everybody else was, and then they all snuck off to take whatever they were taking. And as the music came up, I just sort of came up with them, you know?
Yeah.
So I had no qualifications, and I thought, well, I better do something. So I went to Hammersmith and West London College. Actually, I did a BTEC in performing arts, and I thought I'd better do one A-level just to prove that I can do academic work. So I did the A-level at night school. And went to, absolutely assumed I would get into Cambridge. And then I think Cambridge kind of went, look, it's all very well putting rehab down on your UCAS form, but it's not the sort of thing, dear chap. So I went to Bristol. I met amazing people to make comedy with.
So did you, when you applied to university, that's interesting, were you upfront about that you'd been in rehab?
I was actually, because yeah. I had to explain on my UCAS form what had happened. There was a gap of 2 years. Mm. And obviously, especially, I don't think I was conscious of it actually, but especially for posh people, lots of posh people can sort of, you know, I just sort of, you know, I went away. I don't know, God, I just ski season. You know, like nothing of any value. Value to them, to us. But, and I thought, well, I have to explain what's happened here. So I put on the form, having, you know, whatever it was, having had problems with addictions, this is where I was at that time. And then this is what I did next. And I think, you know, I was probably less well qualified than a lot of people who got on that course at Bristol. But I think, at least as much as they looked at it, they'd have seen, oh, okay, he's a self-starter. Do you know what I mean?
And when did the North Sea oil rig happen?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that.
And other questions I never thought I'd ask.
So it may not surprise you to learn that being a dancer at the Ministry of Sound is less of a career and more of a thing you do some weekends. And So I met some people who were looking for cheap student labour to go and work on oil rigs that were not drilling. So they bring the rigs into the firths in the northeast of Scotland, the Cromarty Firth particularly, and they fix them up to send them back out to sea. These are the exploration rigs that actually bore the hull. So, and there were some jobs going on there, and I went, oh, well, that sounds great. So I showed up, and what I had no idea about, and I'm now mortified about, is that there were a lot of people working on that rig who were laid off in exchange for people like me, cheap labour, because they just didn't need people with any qualifications, you know, so why pay them that sort of money when they could pay me absolute buttons? And when you arrive on an oil rig and you find out you've replaced the friends of the people who are there, I think, you know, the guys on that rig were amazing. And
what did you learn from the oil rig that you think applies, you know, that you still use today?
I'd tell you one thing from the point of view of starting life posh is some people work for a living. You know, there's a thing I learned. Some people actually work for a living. When you hear someone on Question Time going, you know, we want to reward hard-working families. I mean, the reality is that money makes money faster than work can in the UK, and that's been the case for a long time. If you've got money, it'll just earn you more money, and that's it. But a lot of people really work, and I'd met people who did very long hours. My dad, you know, my dad's a hard working man, but the guys I met on the rig were of a different order, you know. So I learned that. I learned how to grease nipples, which is...
Well, that was at Ministry of Sound.
That was also Ministry. There's amazing crossover. Yeah, it was day one. They gave me this amazing crane operator called Keith. He was a Macam from Sunderland, who I thought was a Geordie and said as much, and he was livid. That's a mistake you make once only.
Can't do that.
But Keith had, no word of a lie, Keith had Love and Hat on his knuckles, tattooed on his knuckles, because Keith, being a crane operator, had tragically lost his little finger on his left hand under a crane wire. So all that was left of Love and Hate was Love and Hat. And my friend Andy and I used to, I mean, it was high risk. Keith could have killed us. We used to go past him, go, oh, I know, dear, everybody loves a hat. I know the most wonderful milliner near Aberdeen, do you? So Keith kind of hated and took us under his wing and showed us all sorts of stuff. And a lot of it was standing out on the deck as Keith moved very, very heavy things on the crane and sort of dropped them very near to us. And it was amazing. It was amazing. You climb up the ladder about 120 foot onto deck level. And I worked on the rig for about 9 months and I never got over it. Mm-hmm. Of just being, this is nuts. This is the maddest thing you've ever seen.
How interesting. God, Marcus, what an amazing life you're having.
I've been very lucky in terms of fuel for comedy and writing and, you know, and thinking about narratives and stories and people. It's been...
Well, I'm interested.
Pretty great.
I'm keen to know how the shift into comedy happened. Was that something that you first started getting interested in at university? Had you always had a passion for comedy and stand-up?
No, I went... So, what happened? So, I wanted to go to drama school. That was my plan. And then I applied and didn't even get a recall. I mean, it was a disaster. I think what it was is I was... If not the best, I was like the keenest actor on the course that I was doing. So that made me feel like I was a good actor. And compared to people who were really studying it and grafting at it, I really wasn't. And so I went to drama school and I was really shocked. I went and had lunch with a mate and went, God, I don't know what I'm going to do. This was everything that I thought was going to happen. And he said, well, you're not a very good actor anyway, but you are funny. You should go and do comedy. And I said, well, I said, but you can't just do comedy, because I didn't know. And he said, no, I think you can, actually. I think you can just go and do it. And he phoned 2 days later, and he'd booked a gig for me. And I went and did a stand-up competition in Holborn, and I came second, first time out. And
were you very nervous?
Yeah, I really was. I was shaking. And the first, I think I had 7 minutes, and the first three were appalling. And then I stopped. I guess I was slightly less nervous after the first 3 minutes, and changed. And it went great. And I honestly, it's a real cliche, but I walked off stage, and before I'd even sort of reached the side of the stage, I was like, I knew that is it. That is what I want to do. I don't really want to do anything other than that.
Of course, where I'm going is thinking, when you'd been through what you'd been through, rock bottom, in a lot of respects, getting up on stage, did that feel like there was less at stake almost? Do you think it helped in a strange
way? Yes, it definitely helped. There was context, which was that, you know, I'd known people who'd not managed in recovery and then who had died. People I'd been really close with.
Yeah.
People whose sincerity about wanting to recover was the same as mine. It wasn't that they meant it any less. And then they'd just sort of been alive, and then they weren't anymore. They were dead from that. So there was definitely that context. And I think as well, I had... There was just a hunger for it. Like, before that first gig, I could have quoted you in its entirety, Robin Williams Live at the Met. Mm. I could have done you most of Raw and Delirious by Eddie Murphy. And, you know, I'd always had that thing that I could watch Blackadder and the next day be able to just regale people with half of it, doing the impressions and, you know. So I had a hunger for it and a love for comedy, which actually, my dad's a very, very funny man. He's very funny. He doesn't sort of perform very often. Occasionally he'll get up and do a speech, and he's brilliantly funny. And my mum was really passionate about comedy, and I've still got her 7-inch vinyl of Peter Cook doing I Could Have Been a Judge. And so she'd sort of grown up loving Peter Cook and Dudley Moore and stuff like that. And we as a family, we watched The Two Ronnies and Morecambe and Wise, which most people did, I think. But my biggest passion had been The Muppet Show. And I stand by it, saying that The Muppet Show is pound for pound funnier than most of the, you know, as a variety show, it's funnier than most of the comedy shows that were on.
I'm so glad you said that, because I loved The Muppet Show. And in fact, you'll be very impressed by this, but I was growing up, we had a 70s pop star who lived next door to us.
Oh, yeah.
And she said, I've got someone house sitting. I'm going to L.A., and Jim Henson moved in.
No way.
But we were like, God.
I'd have been over the fence with sock puppets going, hey, Jim, hey, it's me. Just desperate for his attention. Did you meet him then?
Yeah. You could tell he had that sort of childlike, unspoilt heart.
Absolutely.
Which is why
I've been reading his biography for about a year now. It's too big. It has an awful lot of, like, and it was at this time that Jim's aunt's tennis partner's dog's previous owner got a new house in Milwaukee. It has a lot of detail where you're like, shut up and tell me about Kermit. So, but I heard a thing recently, and I don't know if this is true, but it does make sense to me that Jim Henson really wasn't very into puppets. He was into TV, I know that's true, and he was into stories.
Yes.
And
he
jokes.
He was a storyteller, basically, and like you say, he liked stand-up and he was funny and he was...
He was so funny. My God, the jokes. And so I remain a big fan of that. And so, yeah, I just... Once I thought, oh, comedy, then I was so hungry for it. I was just like just a missile for comedy. And I was weird as hell. When I got to Bristol, I was so weird. I just... Anyone who I thought was funny, I literally gave business cards to them. Can you imagine? It was awful. I was so socially messed up by what had happened in my life. Not looking at the floor and kicking my toes, but socially awkward in that I just didn't really mind very much what you thought was okay, which is now something that I would value, but at that time...
And sort of necessary to do your job.
I think for other people it was too much. But there were two... A guy called Danny Robbins, who's now the mastermind behind 222, A Ghost Story, the Battersea Poltergeist, and da-da-da. So Danny and I were a double act for some time, and then Dan Tetzel... and Danny and I were a sketch group, and we had various TV shows and radio shows and all of that. And they were guys that in week one of being at Bristol, I went too close and went, look, I think you're very funny. And I'm mostly here to make comedy. I'm sorry for being tall, but look, let's do some things. And they were like, all right, weird man, you're so weird. And then they'd go, should we go and have a drink? I'd go, no, I don't drink. I've worked on an oil rig and I'm a dancer. Come on.
It sounds like you were just unafraid to ask for what you wanted at that
point. Definitely. You know? Definitely. And so loved what we did. I mean, we did, Dan and Danny and I, and lots of other people too, but, you know, we did a new sketch show at least twice a year, wrote a whole new sketch show and did it and... gigged it around and toured it and took it to Edinburgh. We did stand-up shows, we did improv, we just did everything. And so by the time I left Bristol, then I was like, I don't know about ready, but I'd won the BBC New Comedy Award, and you know, I was just so loving what I was doing that it, I guess my enthusiasm for it made it feel easy.
Yeah.
And let's face it, I'm a posh university educated, straight white, or predominantly straight white man. And, you know, there were some routes for people like us. I don't know if you've heard, but we've had one or two advantages over the years.
Obviously, your comedy career really took off.
Yeah.
And you ended up, you did a lot of radio. You were doing the Now Show, weren't you?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And TV, did that come after things like Have I Got News For You and sort of, you know, Would I Lie To You?
It all kind of happened at a similar time. So the first thing was a series called We Are History, where I played a spoof. I played a history presenter, a sort of Simon Sharma-esque character, Dr. David Oxley, brackets B.A. Ons. And he was awful, and it was really fun. God, it was so fun to do. And then there were various things that came along, like Channel 4 did a sketch show called Barking, which had in the cast, it's amazing, Catherine Tate, Omid Jalili, David Walliams, I think Matt Lucas was in some of them. So it's sort of lots of things happened at once, and then I kind of, I got, even though it was probably seen by the smallest number of people, it's probably the thing I'm most proud of. I did a thing called The Late Edition on BBC Four when BBC Four was relatively new. I loved The Daily Show and loved what Jon Stewart was doing, and I felt very strongly, and still do, that the UK ought to have one of those, and it ought to be live, and it ought to be at least four nights a week, maybe five. And so I did that. My show was live. It was only one night a week, but it was really good. We did some great stuff, great stuff, with John Oliver, actually, who's doing fine.
Whatever
I believe.
Happened to him?
Well, I think he's fine. Poor Lamb had to move to America.
I really hope you loved part one of this week's Walking the Dog. If you want to hear the second part of our chat, it'll be out on Thursday. So whatever you do, don't miss it. And remember to subscribe so you can join us on our walks every week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.